You are listening to Kilometer Zero by the Cycling Podcast.
E si faceva anche quello, la pecora, cioè la rosina di pecora, proprio perché appunto non si pensava di ammassare l'agnello per fare la rosicina. Si faceva la pecora. Questo è un po' un riassunto della
storia.
Well, Brian, what you got there?
Well, I had a... Everything is local, usually, and that's what we like about the Giro as well. I had a tartar of... local, I think it was vitello, so veal from the area with truffles. There was a sign outside the door that this is one of the places to go and eat the local truffles. It was, but it had like a combination of various citrus fruits to like freshen it up. It was quite pleasant, but still heavy, as you know, as relatively raw meat will always be.
And Brian, we had a lovely sort of summary, resoconto, as they say in Italy, of the kind of gastronomic, the sort of lie of the land. Waiter, we're in quite a traditional restaurant, aren't we? White tablecloth tonight. We're at the bottom.
Very elegant place.
Yeah, very elegant. We're at the bottom of the climb to Blockhouse, effectively. We just heard.
I wouldn't climb to Blockhouse after eating here.
No, we wouldn't. But Brian, it's one of the joys of being on the Giro, isn't it? It's something that we glory in this on the podcast. And I think, you know, as the years go by, Italy's place in the world is, well, it's more and more synonymous with its gastronomy. And
it's food traditions,
partly because of things like our podcast. We continue to exalt this, we continue to celebrate this. And
but also, I think when you say gastronomy, you also sometimes imply that it's like haute cuisine, you know, really fine dining, which I don't think Italy, I don't think there's a reflection of fine dining in Italian food, because it's more your everyday food that they just perfect, elevate to new levels. I always try and avoid Michelin restaurants in Italy because I would.
Do you?
I really do.
I thought you were trying to book one earlier.
No. It's more so. I like local dishes made with what's in season. I don't mind it being tried, like, if they sometimes want to perfect it, but I don't want foam on my plate in Italy.
Well, Brian, this is the story that's told. This is the story that we tell of the ancient traditions passed down from generation to generation, from the countryside mainly. It's the image you see on the label of your pasta sauce. Is it the truth, however?
Apparently not.
We might find out why. And it might not be the truth. And the other thing that we often, well, we talk about and we laugh about a lot is the dogmatic nature of Italian food culture and the intransigence that's connected to Italian food culture. We talk about these rules, these canons that they have. You can't have a cappuccino after 11 o'clock. You can't have parmesan with an arrabbiata.
You can't put cheese on fish dishes. You can't have garlic in an amatriciana. So there's all these rules that you kind of feel like it's the totem. It what defines the identity of Italian food. And I understand we're doing some myth-busting in this Kilometer Zero.
Well, I think we are, Brian. There is someone, and he's not even a foreigner, he's an Italian, who has set about, he's made it his, I wouldn't say his life's work, but certainly his mission over the last few years to bust some of these myths. And he's been causing quite a stir in Italy, particularly since an interview he gave with the Financial Times a few weeks ago. His name is Alberto Grandi. He is a professor at the University of Parma, and he has become public enemy number one in Italy. He's been attacked by very prominent politicians like Matteo Salvini, various other people. Salvini said that he was a so-called expert. So, as I said, he's become a bit of a marked man, shall we say. And do you know what, Brian? Well, I spoke to him a few weeks ago about all of this furore. We're going to hear a lot from Alberto Grandi.
And
Questa è una buona domanda. Credo che siano state sia reali che aspre, in realtà. Nel senso, io ho ricevuto molti messaggi.
I've received a lot of messages and a lot of emails, even offensive and kind of threatening ones, because it's touched a very raw nerve for the Italians. It's all been very real. A large share of the animosity towards me is due to the fact that the Italian newspapers badly translated the first interview, the one I gave to the Financial Times. And so there was a lot of manipulation. The National Farmers Confederation was very manipulative in the way they used that interview. And the same with the consortium of Parmesan cheese producers. They continue to do that and so fuel the hatred. I don't know if that's the right word. I'm talking about this resentment or at least ill feeling towards me. Yesterday, a very long article came out in the Mattino di Napoli that attributes things to me that I've never said. Like, that I say Italian food is no good, that Parmesan was born in America, that pizza was born in America, which of course I never said. A very interesting article came out in the Gazzetta di Parma attacking me and somehow lumping together my opinions on Italian cuisine with the issues of synthetic meat and the nutritional value of insects. That's to say, it basically throws everything into the same pot and argues that ultimately the purpose of all of this is to destroy Italian cuisine an Italian gastronomic culture. Basically, that I'm some kind of undercover gastronomic agent, a spy working on behalf of the British. The fact is that in Italy, you eat very good things, but this has practically nothing to do with the history of Italy, or rather, it's much more complicated than the way it's often told. The ridiculous story that's always told is that in Italy, Italians have always eaten well and we're the best. But then, as I always say, why did 25 million leave if they ate spaghetti, macaroni, pizza, meat stews and tortellini all day? It's also something the British historian Eric Hobsbawm was talking about in the 1970s. He edited a book about it, The Invention of Tradition. All that I wrote in my book in 2018 was fruit of what other people had written. The problem is that these food historians, and there are some very good ones among them who have done extraordinary work, never had the courage or the opportunity to put their work into the mainstream public domain. Moreover, that book is somehow also the result of my personal frustration because I myself, who knew these things, would find myself trotting out the same myths in public. So somehow I couldn't summon the courage either. There was this separation between the rigorous research I was doing and the information I then passed on to the public. In the end, as I always say, all I revealed is that Father Christmas doesn't exist, because I never said there'll be no gifts under the tree. I said there will be presents for everyone to unwrap. It's just that Father Christmas didn't bring them.
L'origine del nome praticamente è antichissimo, risale all'epoca romana,
sì.
Oltre 2000 anni fa, perché i romani quando partivano per le conquiste, per andare in giro, si portavano dei
Well, Brian, who was that we just heard? Not Alberto Grandi. We'll get back to him in a minute, but the voice we heard after him.
That was it's the owner and chief philosopher of a very old restaurant here in Teramo, and it's called Marcello Schillaci. And the restaurant is called La Cantina di Porta Romana.
Well, and this relates very much, doesn't it, to the subject really of this podcast, because he was talking food traditions, and one food tradition in particular, and typically of Italy. This is a food tradition that has found itself at the center of a controversy over the last few years. Tell us a bit more, Brian.
Yeah, so the controversy is surrounding a very specific dish for Teramo called Il Virtù.
Le Vertù?
Le Vertù. And it's, you can't call it a minestrone, but just to exemplify what it looks like, it's a type of minestrone, but it's very specific for a certain time of year here. Some only eat it on May 1st here at this restaurant. And I'm pretty sure he's sort of the
bizarre.
Yeah, he's the main purveyor of this tradition. He, as you can see here on the sign, you can eat it from the 25th of April and through the month of May. And as we were walking by trying to see what it looked like, he came out and invited us in to have a taste.
And he himself has been at the center of some of these controversies because he's sort of started and is the president or the chairman of this association for the protection of the Vertù, which I thought, because the Italian word for virtue is Vertù, so I thought that was where the name came from. He explains to us it's not. It probably comes from the Greek to stir, because originally, well, it was the basically leftover ingredients from winter, which were stirred to lower the temperature, stop them fermenting. They're then combined with the new ingredients of the sort of spring crop, and that's basically how you get the dish.
But Brian, it's an ancient tradition, or so Marcello says. He talked about it being over 2,000 years old, and we hear this kind of story a lot in Italy, don't we? And this brings us back to Alberto Grandi, because, well, Brian, we heard him talk about how he has been at the centre of all this kerfuffle, all this fuss, and he's been attacked and threatened. But specifically, what is it that people are most upset about? What's he said that people really have taken umbrage to?
Well, to give you an example, and it's
sorry, have taken exception to.
Well, to give you the most sort of poignant example is the origin of the Parmesan cheese, the Parmigiano Reggiano, which is obviously based in a certain part of Italy, and they claim, and they legally can claim, that they're the only ones who can make it. But he's traced the origins of that type of cheese back to Italian immigrants of Wisconsin. And they still make that cheese. It's a lot smaller, you know, the big wheels of Parmesan cheese are around 40 kilos. But this Wisconsin version of it is 1 kilo, and it's sort of covered in dark rind. And there's an aspect to this that's quite interesting, and also why this is a very serious debate. It's not just sort of, you know, people having an argument on the piazza. There's a thing in Italy called the DOP, and it's a bit like you have a DOC in wine, and it's Denominazione Origine Protetta. So it's a protection of the origin and what creates the area where it can be made. So what Alberto Grandi really does is he violates the copyrights of the Parmesan cheese by saying, you know, it's actually from somewhere else, and it for some people, it opens the door for everyone to start producing it, or maybe them actually claiming that they are the only ones who can produce the real Parmesan, you know, which is, it's a crazy thought, you know, it's almost ironic, but it's not to the people who are trying to protect these local specialities.
And in fact, well, he has directly, squarely thumbed his nose at these denominazioni di origine protetta and controllata. The title of his book that he wrote in 2018 was Denominazione di Origine Inventata, which basically, well, it condenses, it encapsulates that one of the main theses of Alberto Grandi is that the history of Italian food as we know it today has been invented. And it's been invented, it's been rewritten in the last 50 years. And he's taken aim, you mentioned there Parmesan, he's taken aim at, for example, the origin of carbonara sauce. He's taken aim at pizza or
cappuccino.
He's got some thoughts on that. He's got some thoughts on pretty much everything. All of the canons.
Tiramisu, something that we've over the years have spent a lot of time, at least tasting and talking about during the Giro.
But he's very upset that, well, he's been writing about these and researching these things for a long time, and the book came out in 2018. However, as a result of this recent interview with the Financial Times, the controversies, whatever controversies and whatever sort of consternation there was about what he has said, has gone to a different level. But one of his
buy t-shirts critiquing him, and there was a sort of type of GoFundMe campaign where people could donate money to, you know, cause, I'm sure, quiet but serious riots about how he has rewritten the history of their local specialities.
But he's not the first person to write about this subject, and this is one of the things that's aggrieved him, that a lot of this information has been out there for a long time. For example, we're going to hear from him now, in fact, John Dickey, another one of my former Italian professors. He wrote a book a few years ago called Delizia, and he's an Englishman. And well, we asked him what he's made of the Alberto Grandi controversy, kerfuffle, polemica.
Exactly, polemica.
Hi, Daniel. How are you doing?
John. Not too bad, thanks. Thank you for doing this. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sitting outside an autogrill on the way from Rome to Pescara, which seems very appropriate
okay.
to talk about this.
There's a new edition of my History of Italian Food coming out. And actually had a really nice chat with Alberto, who said that he was inspired to write his book by reading my book. So that's all very nice. So I've returned the favour by kind of talking briefly about his case in the new chapter that I've done for the updated edition of Delizia, which will be out for sort of November. I mean, we too are attacked to the sort of rural myth of Italian food, you know, the sort of Dolmio family out in the vineyard kind of vision of Italian food, you know, those adverts for the awful pasta sauces. That's what we want Italian food to be. I suppose people find it quite endearing that our Italians are so attached to this. In some ways, there's as much resistance in Britain, among people who love Italian food in Britain, as there is in Italy, or nearly as much, to the idea that this is largely a myth. This idea of the rural origins of Italian food is complete claptrap, as that as Alberto Grandi says, is largely made up in the 1970s, by which time, of course, Italians had left the peasant life behind, by and large. Italian food has, and I love Italian food, has kind of, you know, successfully branded itself as being about artisanal authenticity and peasant roots and all of that kind of thing. And it's nice to see a kind of challenge to that, getting an getting more of an airing in Britain. You know, it's, Alberto Grandi has been saying these things for a while. And he only caused a real, real political storm when it got echoed in the Financial Times and was relayed back home, you know. Alberto has his finger on the pulse more than I do, but his sense is that young people aren't interested in this stuff. It all feels a bit old fogey-ish, this endless purism about recipes and it's also... you know, a kind of knee-jerk reaction from the sort of gastro-nationalists in the current government against, you know, or artificially created meat, for example, going for the yuck factor of, you know, science interfering with our diets. You know, we're going to need all the help we can get to get out of this environmental crisis. And we don't know yet, you know, quite what these new sciences can achieve in terms of food. And Italy's never turned its back on science in the past, or at least it hasn't, if science can disguise itself. You know, the very good example of that is the Mediterranean diet. You know, that was invented by an American epidemiologist, Ansel Keys. But of course, because it got wrapped up in all this, you know, genuine Italian stuff, Italians loved it. But it's as modern as hell. You know, that too is a product, you know, of the 1970s. Ansel Keys's the recipe book he wrote with his wife, I think, came out in 1974, and that really was what started the craze off for the Mediterranean diet and stopped people in kind of the north cooking with strutto and made them, you know, suck in olive oil from all over the world to feed Italians' hunger for it.
So, Daniel, you spoke at great length with Alberto Grandi. What are the main takeaways from that conversation?
I mean, the thing that really struck me, Brian, was, well, I expected us to sort of go through a litany of Italian culinary sacred cows and slaughter them. And we sort of did. And anyone who's interested in the real origins of, for example, the name of a margherita pizza, or pizza itself, or carbonara, or tiramisu, we've talked about that a lot on the podcast, well, they can listen to the complete Alberto Grandi interview with subtitles. We're going to put it on YouTube, I think, in the next few days. But what I didn't expect to get, but what I was treated to by Alberto, was this potted history of Italian culinary tradition. And we talked in particular about three key moments. One, obviously, being the, as you would expect, maybe the unification of Italy in the 1860s, something we've talked about a lot on the podcast. And the situation at that time, as Alberto described to me, was a pretty miserable one for most Italians, rural Italians. And it got worse in the 1870s. There was an agrarian crisis, but there wasn't too much distinction between the north and the south, but they were eating four or five foodstuffs, ingredients. In the north, they ate polenta. That was one difference. In the south, they didn't have polenta. But otherwise, it was pretty miserable. And as he rightly says, why did so many Italians leave in that period, and certainly over the next 40, 50 years, estimates range from 15 to 20 million Italians left if things were so good, which is what we're led to believe sometimes by this mythology around rural Italian cooking and gastronomy. And then the next key thing we talked about was this migration, this great Italian migration, particularly of southerners to America in the first 15 years of the 20th century. And this had a really interesting effect because, as I said, a lot of them were southerners. And this is the sort of Hollywood really embraced and kind of crystallized this image of the southern Italian in the flat cap. And in most cases, in most portrayals, he was sort of a mafioso. It was a real sort of crass, stereotypical image. But what happens is these southern Italians, they go away and they find new ingredients. And they combine those ingredients also with a sort of nostalgia for home. So there's some elements of the gastronomy and the culinary traditions they've come from, but they start to create something new. And there's also a third element, which was a sort of Bible of Italian cooking, the only real Bible of Italian cooking at that time, which was written by a guy called Pellegrino Artusi. And they have access to this book, a lot of these Italians. And it's a bit of a mishmash, but they take elements of that, this sort of nostalgia for home, new ingredients.
It's a fusion kitchen.
It's a fusion of sorts. And they kind of put it back together, and then they go back to Italy eventually, a lot of them. And this has a profound effect on what we now know as Italian cooking. And things like pizza existed in Napoli prior to this mass migration. However, it was quite different from the pizza that we know today. It was a sort of a sweet focaccia, Alberto said to me, and there was certainly no tomatoes on it. But the migrants or the emigres, they go back home, and over the course of a couple of decades, this new dish starts to become popular, and it's basically the pizza we know today. And in fact, this phenomenon is well documented. It's documented by sociologists, and they call it the pizza effect. And it's also been seen with things like samosas in India as well. So that was really fascinating. And then the next key moment, Brian, was sort of 60s, 70s, and in some of the interviews he's given, Alberto Grandi has talked about this as the sort of the birthplace, the genesis of the mythology that we now have come to associate with Italian cooking. And this is something that John Dickey has also written about.
I mean, what he says is basically you have a moment in the 1970s where the sort of the dreams of that were generated during the economic boom begin to be questioned. You have a series of environmental and food scandals like that wine poisoning scandal or, you know, those sorts of things. You have the economic downturn. You have the years of lead. It's all suddenly not looking so good. And you have youth cultures emerging and so on. And this kind of troubled moment is when Italians start to look back, look to the countryside, not as something, thank God I've left that behind, but as something that was more genuine, simpler, you know, this sort of whole nostalgia fable. I think that's what he's doing. And there's an awful lot of evidence to support that. I mean, kind of, you know, in some ways, slow food comes out of that out of that vibe. Things like, you know, you start to get these sagre of all sorts of weird local food. And things like, you know, just one example in 1974, I think it was, the learned fraternity of the Tortellino in Bologna deposited a legal deed in the Chamber of Commerce of Bologna, setting the recipe for tortellini in stone. I suppose where I would be slightly differ from Alberto Grandi is that he I see longer term continuities along with other historians like Giovanni Rebora and others, longer term continuities in the sort of urban lifestyle aspect, the city aspect of Italian eating. That's where you really find it. You know, that's where Italian food as we know it really comes from. The weird thing is, that just as Italian food became really successful and internationally respected and all that kind of stuff, it started to kind of misrecognize its own history as a sort of history of peasant food. So that's the strange thing.
Gli italiani sono invece estremamente flessibili.
I don't think this lack of flexibility is typical of Italians generally. I think we're extremely flexible and accommodating with respect to everything except food. We don't give a damn about anything. We couldn't give two hoots. But if you put pancetta instead of guanciale in the carbonara, you might get crucified. But I have a theory about that too, why we're so picky about food. Well, it's because our cuisine 50 years ago was not considered, and so in order for us to gain a lead, we had to become almost caricatures. I always remind my students of how in 2021, when Italy didn't deliver the 250,000 doses of AstraZeneca to Australia, a politician theatrically snapped his linguine in half and put some kind of condiment and cream, then said, "We will call it carbonara until you give us the vaccine." In my opinion, this fastidiousness is now as much a part of the brand of Italian cuisine as the ingredients or dishes. As I say, it was a necessary means to the end of creating an identity.
Questo fa parte un po' della costruzione della tradizione e della e dell'immagine che l'Italia ha costruito all'estero.
Conosco una carusa, tu n'hai bella, vicino casa mia, na vicino casa mia, vicino casa mia, stai e de casa.
Maximilian Chandri, sport director of Movistar Team. So, I mean, I still remember a friend of mine what used to live in Huntington Beach called Ron, and I went there when I went to America in 1985. You know, obviously, as you said, my dad's a chef and he has restaurants in LA, and I used to go and see this guy, and he was like, "Let's do some macaroni." Okay, and then the next thing he just grabs his macaroni from a box and he puts them in a microwave oven. For sure, you get offended. But whatever you do, I think you're always going to pull out pasta. You're always going to pull out olive oil. You're always going to pull out a bit of spicy, you know, a bit of peperoncino. Anything you can, then whatever you do with it. But the base is all Italian, you know. Whatever you do with anything of your food. You can mix pasta and cereal. I've seen that doing. Cereal. I saw... all sorts of stuff with bike riders in the days, you know. But I still think the Italian food is the top quality of the base ingredients. Then however you mix them ingredients, it's up to you, wherever you live in the world, you know. Kev can tell you a nice little story, you know, how I taught him to do spaghetti al pomodoro fresco. And he always says that, you know, it's a little thing. It's like, hey, Max, you taught me how to do pomodoro, you know, like little cherry tomatoes and you know, drop the pasta when it's still almost not finished cooking and throw them in the pomodoro, you know. So stuff like that. I never seen G really do much, but one guy who really shocked me was Stannard. Stannard would put like Heinz beans and cereal together and just eat a big old bowl of stuff. And I was like, when I was with the academy, I was like, guys, yeah, because these guys used to cook for themselves, you know. So I mean, a bunch of English guys coming to Italy, Tuscany, you know, where bloody hell, it's like, there you go, that's the healthiest place you can have. And I was teaching these guys how to make themselves not one massive plate of food, but have the portion of pasta, rice or risotto or whatever it was, and then do a second course and just enjoy that time they'll spend eating, you know. So it was pretty funny in them days, you know, you see these guys doing crazy, but the craziest one was Stannard. He used to mix anything.
It's actually true, like Max actually told me to cook pasta properly. Okay, anyone could cook pasta, but to cook pasta like an Italian, you know, it's really, really true. It's not an Italian bigging themselves up, but like, showed us how to properly boil the water, bring it down, and how to cook the tomatoes. I used that a lot when I was younger as well, you know. Probably made it for my wife when I first met her.
The whole Italian intransigence about food, you can't have this with that, you can't...
It's so good, isn't it?
Do you like it?
I quite find it funny. I just really quite like it, you know. Yeah, then when you get like a British come over and order a cappuccino with a dinner, and you're like, even I start to get a bit... It is funny though. It was you that told me about it. That Twitter thing that Italians mad at food. Oh, funny.
Oh, last Christmas I had a cheeseburger pizza from Domino's and it was absolutely banging. It was lovely. It wasn't like a cheeseburger.
I knew you'd come out with something like this.
On a pizza, but it was like ground mince, nice bit of sauce, a few gherkins, bloody lovely. So, it's all a bit great. It's all a bit, I say crazy, but you know, the traditions are nice, but I like to break them though.
Oh, well, I mean, there's lots of fun to be had with them, I think. I mean, I think there is a kind of wisdom of crowds aspect to this. And if, you know, if Italians, lots of Italians say, look, it's really not a good idea to have a cappuccino after about 11 o'clock in the morning. I think there's probably a good reason for that. You know, so I'm instinctively want to try and blend in and follow the rules. But it can be crazy. I mean, one thing I recently looked at was, you know, the pasta alla gricia, you know, the Roman dish with guanciale and strutto and all this kind of, and pecorino and so on. And you know, massive fuss created when MasterChef, the two MasterChef chefs, Cracco and Bastianich, suggested putting onion in it. And, you know, champions of the orthodoxy and so on and so forth, and this was how the peasant, it wasn't the peasant, it's the shepherds in that case, is always used to do it. Absolutely no evidence to support that. And in fact, the oldest recipe for anything like that we have, you know, Italians have been dressing pasta with various forms of pork and fat and cheese for as long as they've been eating pasta. And it's just a very modern obsession to want to make that into a canonical recipe, you know, that thou shalt not transgress. Mm. And in fact, the oldest recipe we have for anything like that is from Ada Boni, who's the great, you know, sort of grand dame of Italian cuisine under fascism. And she includes both onion and abundant pepper. Which is supposedly another massive no-no for the purists. And the other danger of it, of course, is that people are making political capital out of it at the moment. Yeah. You know, this gastro-nationalism is a serious national force. What's his name? Lollo Brigida, you know, who's clearly very close to Meloni, gets the agriculture gig to strike kind of conservative patriotic poses about Italian food.
Well, Brian, we've come to the end of this. Well, it's kind of been almost a menu degustazione, a multi-course meal of polemica for every course. We set out in this episode to talk about the Alberto Grandi furore. He is the Italian food heretic of the moment. Some very interesting takeaways, and there are some parallels with cycling as well. Funnily enough, I spoke to Alberto Grandi also about, you know, he bemoans the fact that no one talks about Italy's great industrial tradition in the 60s and 70s, and there were a lot of brands who were a fruit of the great tradition of innovation that Italy had. For example, manufacturers of coffee machines who have sponsored cycling teams, Samontana, who made ice cream, that has sort of been subsumed. That image that Italy used to have, a sort of captain of innovation, and it's been replaced and squashed and squandered by this sort of bucolic image of, as John Dickey said, well, the kind of image you see on the labels of pasta sauces.
Well, it's also it's a sexier story than, you know, industrial innovations in the north. Shocking revelations as well. I mean, my daughter's middle name is Margherita. That's not... Not just because of my love for that pizza, but also it gives me sort of connotations to something that I thought was like, like an axis of Italian identity, which, you know, I need to think about differently. I won't like the food any less. But the one element, and you and I talk about that, I think every year about the Giro that I think connects to this discussion, is the element of nostalgia. Cycling is probably the most nostalgic sport in the world. Maybe baseball sometimes can be as nostalgic, but
nowhere more so than in Italy.
Exactly, and nowhere more so in the current situation of Italian cycling. You know, there is no professional Italian cycling team at the highest level, at the World Tour level. There is no Italian favorite for even a podium spot at the Giro. So it's as if the race has taken over the role of creating the Italian pride, and they sort of have to be basking in the sunshine of the international riders like Remco Evenepoel and Roglic, and not so much their own favorite riders.
And they've leaned more and more into the sort of prestige of Italy as a tourist destination, and Italy as the cradle of these fantastic foods, for example, foods and wines, and they really try to exalt that
material. You know, when you open the race book, after you see the description, you know, the metrics of the stage, immediately you'll find the local culinary high, you know, points. You'll see what to drink and things like that. So it's, you remember when they started that slogan, I think it was something along the lines of the hardest race in the most beautiful place. So that the beauty is sort of the main character, the main Italian addition. And that bit I agree with wholeheartedly. It is the most beautiful bike race. And I think they, if you compare it to the Tour de France, Italians take pride in that. French people take it for given that of course France is the most beautiful country. I think that expresses itself quite clearly here at the Giro.
Well, Brian, one reason I wanted to do this kilometre zero and tackle this issue was that we ourselves, over the past however many years that we've been doing the Giro d'Italia, we've been guilty sometimes of basking in these clichéd images of Italy and these cliched notions of Italy and almost selling them to our listenership. And this podcast, this Kilometre Zero, is almost a manifesto for us as well to drag Italy, perhaps, or help drag Italy by the wing mirror. Let's imagine, you know, they're off the back of the peloton, you know, towards
to stay within the time limit,
towards something fresher, more innovative, or certainly for us to look more in that direction. And we're going to talk more about this in relation to cycling specifically. How does Italy rebuild as a cycling nation as well? We're going to talk about that in a later episode of Kilometre Zero. But Brian, we've got time, I think. I think we should end this Kilometre Zero by slaughtering one last sacred cow. And it's one beloved to us on the cycling podcast. And it regards cappuccino. Cappuccino, we know it can't be drunk after 11 o'clock. But Brian, did you know that according to Alberto Grandi, well, he's got a theory anyway, it may have been invented by the Germans. Let's hear Alberto one last time, shall we?
In realtà, secondo me, allora, il dato di fatto
I have a theory about it. In my opinion, from a technological point of view, you need the machine invented by Gaggia. It's adapted from a patent for something else, but this one is from 1939. You need the frothing nozzle in the milk, this machine. But then war breaks out and so it doesn't get distributed. But it starts to catch on in the second half of the 50s in Italy, and only then do Italians discover cappuccino. Italians have been drinking lattes forever. Not everyone, because milk is a luxury product, but cafe latte was drunk at home and in bars. Cappuccino is a different thing, but precisely because you need this gadget. Basically, this machine spreads initially on the Adriatic Riviera in the second half of the 50s, then throughout the 60s, then later throughout the rest of Italy. And finally, Italy all gets to know about cappuccino. But the first phase of this machine being widely sold is there. Obviously, Romagnoli live on the Romagnolo Riviera, on that coastline, but German tourists have always flocked there. Not so much now, but until the 90s and 2000s, German tourism was clearly prevalent in that area. It makes me say that the demand by Germans for this cappuccino product may have been decisive in its success.
Mi fa dire che la domanda espressa dai tedeschi di questo prodotto, del cappuccino, potrebbe essere stata decisiva nel successo.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
This episode was produced by Tom Wally.
With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.